Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design. I'm Tom Gilson. Today we bring you an interview between Jerry Boyer and Discovery Institute's John West. The occasion was an article Boyer wrote for Forbes magazine entitled Newly Available Documentary Chronicles the Biochemical Revolution Against Materialism. This led him to interview John West for the Boyer briefing, and Boyer was kind enough to share that interview with us here at ID the Future. Today we bring you the first part of their conversation.
Hi, I'm Jerry Boyer. I want to thank you for listening to us today. I'm talking with Dr. John West from the Discovery Institute about a film that he wrote and directed and has recently been released to the general public free. So this is a documentary that you can watch at no cost online from the Discovery Institute called Revolutionary Behe. And John's here to talk with us about it today. Dr. West, thank you for joining us.
Jerry, thanks for having me. And you can just call me John.
I will. And you just call me Jerry.
Okay.
And let's talk about Michael Behe. Why does this gentleman deserve a documentary about his work? What is so important about his revolution?
Well, he really revolutionized the modern debate in America over Darwin's theory. I think, you know, when I was growing up, it was largely thought, well, this isn't a science debate. It's just about a debate amongst of, you know, religious believers that were focused on how they read the Bible. And then here's this mild-mannered biochemist, someone who'd worked on grants from the National Science Foundation, who was at Lehigh University, who publishes a book in 1996 called Darwin's Black Box that makes an argument against unguided Darwinian evolution from biochemistry, from the molecular machines inside our cells, and points out that not only are these the sort of things that Darwin didn't know about, but really his sort of haphazard, unguided, you know, approach based on random mutations and natural selection really doesn't help explain these things. And so he wrote this book. It was published by a major trade publisher. And he ended up writing about it in the New York Times. It ended up being reviewed in the New York Times. And it really created quite a stir because here, for the first time for many people, a serious biologist was arguing based on modern biology, not based on religious texts, not based on something 100 years ago, but sort of the cutting edge of biology, that there was something more going on and that traditional Darwinism couldn't explain it. And that, in fact, it pointed towards design and purpose in nature. And so that was revolutionary. A lot of people didn't want to see that, and it really catapulted Michael Behe into the public limelight, both for good and for ill, for him personally. And so, you know, it really was a revolution.
Yeah, he's been rather savagely assaulted, for his findings. And I suppose that's an indication of what a threat he is to purely materialistic explanations for the emergence of life in the universe. And I suppose in retrospect, it would not have occurred to me before. By the way, that book was important in my life and in my wife's life. She was at the time an analytical chemist who studied biochemistry at the university level. So that really grabbed her attention and convinced her of the necessity of intelligent design. In retrospect, it's almost obvious that this stunning blow to materialistic versions of evolution would come from the biochemistry level, from the kind of the deepest detail level upwards, rather than from the big structure level downwards, because that's where the complexity is and that's where the signal is hardest to explain if you think it's no signal at all.
Well, and I'd also say if you can't explain it at that most rudimentary level, if you can't even build a one biochemical system using the Darwinian approach, you're not going to be able to build something like us, who are made up of lots of biochemical systems and lots more. You know, when you go up to the major biological features like arms or hearts or the human brain, certainly our legs and things like that. If you can't build at the very base, even small, really small things that are intensely complicated, then you're not going to be able to build anything else. So this is really, in other words, this is also sort of giving the best case scenario for modern Darwinian theory at the biochemical level. And Michael Behe's point is, well, what we're learning is you can't even do anything at that level, and that you really require really a directed approach, a goal-directed approach. Just like when any of us build something in a shop, or if anything's manufactured, I mean, we all know that things don't self-assemble themselves. We know that our computers don't self-assemble themselves. We know that without intentional guidance and purpose, they don't even stay working. Even software won't stay working. It'll degrade if they need all sorts of tweaks all the time. And so it's just like that in biochemistry. It's just what we already should know.
Right. And I suppose that the Behe revolution, I mean, it gave the intelligent design movement its mascot, the flagellum. But I also think it had a certain emotional power to it, because very few people knew about molecular machines. Very few people knew how much these organelles are the inside the cell analog of organs in a body. So, animals, living things are made of cells. Living things have organs in them, and these organs are made of cells. But the cells also have something like organs in them. The cells are not just blobs of protoplasm, like Darwin thought, that just adapt. They are themselves highly complex machines, almost like cities made up of machines. And almost none of us saw down there. So when you see a flagellum that looks just like something that an engineer would make, or when you see transport machines that look like robots walking along strands of string carrying things, that it just all at once you see the complexity down at the bottom of life, and it's visually compelling.
I think you're right. And I think actually one of Mike Behe's great contributions was opening that world that most people really didn't know about. Scientists who were studying it knew about it, but it hadn't been that black box, so to speak, hadn't been opened up to the general public. And when he opened it up, it's a very positive scientific contribution to get people thinking about it. And you're exactly right. We have these transistorized, it is like tiny nanomachines inside our bodies that are amazing. And of course, one of Behe's insights was that in many of these systems, they are so carefully constructed that you take even one piece out of it and it's no longer fulfilling its function.
So he's taking the already existing argument of irreducible complexity, from the body type level down into the microcosm. In other words, so what's irreducible complexity? A lizard can function in the world by running. A bird can function in the world by flying. But a animal who has two forelimbs that aren't quite legs and aren't quite wings is at a competitive disadvantage. So you kind of have to be all the way over to flying wing or way back at four legs that these transitions from one to another are actually survival disadvantages. So they are irreducibly complex in the sense that you have to have all the changes in place before they confer a survival advantage. Did I get that right?
That's right.
That's at the morphological level, but you're saying that's true way down in every individual cell, that these little machines in the cells, they also don't work if the tiniest thing is off.
Well, yeah, and as you already mentioned, Behe's sort of example that entered popular culture is the flagellum, these little bacterial things that they have like an outboard motor, really, that is spinning along, that helps make it move along the cells. It's the flagellum. And if you remove any one of a variety of pieces there, it's not that it's functioning, say, at 50% the speed. It's not providing locomotion. I mean, it doesn't work.
And it's doing nothing but burning calories and not converting any. It's a survival disadvantage, flailing around but not getting anywhere.
It would be an evolutionary dead end. And so that is – now, yes, you could – this is not about sort of piecing something together gradually. If you have a design-based approach where your goal is to get something that will swim – yes, you could put that together a piece at a time. The problem is trying to find a survival value for adding these various things that would kill you if that's all the pieces were there. You know, nothing would be happening. Doing that through an unguided approach really doesn't work.
All right, let's hit some of the counter arguments. One is, yes, but some of these components can appear in nature without design features. You can get some of these structures. You can get some of the parts of the machine. So
go ahead. You're right. So the basic argument, and one of the reasons for this film, by the way, is to tell the influence that Behe has had, but then also how they try to argue against him, but how actually, if you look at the evidence, the arguments really didn't hold water. So you're right. Really, the main argument is sometimes called co-option, sometimes called something else, but that, well, okay, maybe there are these smaller machines that did other things, like not helping to swim, and then the somehow natural selection magically cobbled together those existing systems and added some things, and that's how they got the new function. Well, there are all sorts of problems with those explanations. One is most of them are just so stories that they're just sort of made up. The second one, though, is that many of those underlying systems, like in the bacterial flagellum, they'll say, oh, there is something called the type 3 secretion needle system. And it's true. So there is something that looks like a needle that could be conceived of as a part of the larger flagellar structure. Well, many of these subsystems themselves are irreducibly complex. So you're actually not explaining. You're going into a regress.
Where did the needle syringe system come from? It's
correct.
You still have the irreducible complexity. By the way, what are those for? What does that do? Does that inject something?
Yeah, it injects sort of like toxins. It just tries to kill things.
So it's a stinger.
Yeah.
All right. So that's almost as complex as the flagellum. Right.
Well, but here's the thing. Actually, the best evidence, I mean, there's so many problems with that particular one, but one of the doozies is it turns out that most evolutionary biologists now believe that stinger complex or, you know, the needle complex, actually, it is because it's less complicated, they think it devolved from the flagellum. So in other words, the flagellum broke down. And then sort of this subsystem sort of formed out of it. Well, no one doubts, and Behe doesn't doubt, that you can take functioning systems and knock something out of a functioning system and maybe salvage something from that. You know, that's sort of devolution. That's not building something new. That's actually not what Darwin thought he was explaining. He thought he was explaining the building of fundamentally new features, not taking existing things and, yeah, if you knock something out of it, maybe it could then function as something else. I mean, that's just, like I said, that's a real doozy. For all the thousands of words that have been written attacking Behe on this, what's turned out over the past two decades is that the best evidence among the evolutionary biologists themselves is that the needle complex didn't help originate the flagellum. It was the other way around. The flagellum existed, and then maybe it broke down in a certain way that allowed the other one to fall.
Well, there's an interesting point to be made here about something that I think is a very commonly used argument against intelligent design, which is a straw man, which is that intelligent design proponents say that everything in life is intelligently designed. And that doesn't seem to be the case. Bill Dembski once explained it to me this way. He said, you can walk around and you can see a car and say a car was intelligently designed, right? You can walk around, you can walk along and see a rock outcropping and say, well, that's, clearly that's a random process of breaking down through water erosion or whatever. But what if you're walking in the woods and you see a broken down, rusted car? Clearly there's design, but clearly there's also entropic undesign. So the existence of things that are breakdowns of evolutionary order are not they're not a defeater for intelligent design. They're not a case that contradicts it, because ID advocates see entropy. They don't deny the existence of entropy, therefore don't deny the existence of anti-design features of breakdown in information.
No, you're exactly right, and that is a straw man, and you're exactly right. Things do break down, and the claim that we have good evidence that some things are designed isn't the claim that absolutely everything you see is designed. Something else, though, that I think has really not been covered in this, that I was the hope of this documentary, is a lot of these arguments about, say, the flagellum, or, you know, could there be an evolutionary pathway or not, is completely theoretical. And there's sort of like what Rudyard Kipling used to say, just so stories, that people are making speculations, but it's actually not based on evidence. What has happened over the past 20 years, though, and Michael Behe had a key role in this as well, is, well, now we actually have some pretty good evidence from the laboratory of what natural selection actually can do at the biochemical level. And this was really the story of Behe's second book that many people don't know about, The Edge of Evolution. And so, you know, for most things, you can't test Darwinian theory exactly because we don't have millions of years here. But the one place you can test it in real time is bacteria, because there you have population sizes of millions and millions, and a generation time that it could just be of a few hours. And so you actually can test in real time, not just speculative models, not just, you know, jerry-rigged computational models that you just put in the data that you want and fine-tune it to work, but actually what happens in the lab. And this, like I said, is the story of Michael Behe's second book, Edge of Evolution, which we also tell in this film. And it, the real bottom line answer is it ain't much. Basically, you can create some very small level changes, but if you need more than just a couple coordinated changes to get the function that you're trying to get, which most things in life, you're going to need multiple coordinated mutations and things to be able to get anything that actually works. It doesn't work. And we now know that. I mean, we know that in the lab.
There's a real-time experiment that's been going on, right, with this?
There have been multiple. The most famous is at Michigan State University with Richard Lenski, who's a big-time Darwinist. But his actual data undercuts his theory. And
how long has that been going on?
Oh, I want to say, well, it's been like up to 60, 70, 80,000 generations. So, I mean, it's been going on for a fair number of years. I mean, I think more than a decade.
Yeah, I think so, too. So your point is, all right, Darwinists might say, listen, we can't wait around for great apes to turn into proto-hominids because that is a decimillion type process. Okay, great. And you say, okay, but the building blocks of that are in individual cells. So we can create a gigantic vat of bacteria and feed it everything at once and do millions and millions and millions and millions of generations and take samples and see whether we find, you know, evolutionary process. I mean, you know, I mean, something should be adapting to the environment and taking over, right? Taking over that food source. And that hasn't happened. So if, I think of this in terms of a Bayesian reasoning, if Darwinism were true, the best place to find it would be at the cellular level, and we don't find it at the cellular level. Therefore, it's unlikely to be true.
Yeah. And in credit to these experiments, it's even more detailed than that. I mean, we now can understand, you know, how many mutations or changes it would take to get one, say, specific trait that, say, a particular type of bacteria can ingest something more than before or something. And so, you know, we're getting that sort of knowledge, and we're now having the knowledge that if you use Darwinian processes to try to get to that place, even if there is a survival advantage ultimately for the change, if it requires more than just a couple of coordinated mutations in order to get there, it doesn't even take that path. It just it doesn't work. And then one other thing, that's in the lab. Michael Behe pointed out that we have a couple of things in nature that we've been able to study, like malaria, that it's been so studied, and you've had, you know, hundreds and millions of generations and, you know, all around the world, and we know that it can break down certain things, but it doesn't lead to really new major changes. And his point, and the main criticisms of his second book, Edge of Evolution, were, oh, they didn't debate the facts that he brought out. They said, well, we can come up with this computational model that shows how you can sort of get it to work. Even if that were the case, which actually really wasn't the case, but let's grant it, computational theoretical models do not refute actual empirical evidence of what happens in the lab or in nature.
Right.
I mean, you have to have some better explanation. Well, we could jerry-rig a model that's theoretical that shows how it might work, even though it hasn't worked.
Well, it's interesting to see scientism at work here and a real-life experiment on if there's a conflict between materialism and empiricism, which one gets thrown out of the lifeboat? Materialism gets to stay. Empiricism goes all out into the drink.
That was Jerry Boyer of the Boyer Briefing interviewing John West, Associate Director of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Stay tuned for part two of their conversation soon. For ID the Future, this is Tom Gilson. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.